Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to maintain mental wellness so that we can manage the challenges in our own lives, engage positively with other people, and feel pretty good about ourselves? My guest today believes we can all benefit from self-knowledge and self-growth and from learning to exist somewhere in the healthy space between emotional chaos and emotional rigidity. Psychotherapist Philippa Perry shares what she has learned in a new book called simply How to Stay Sane. Philippa, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What does it mean to be sane?
Well, isn't that interesting? Because we've got so many definitions of what it means to be insane. I mean, there are so many little tick box tests to, gauge your insanity. But there is no tick box test for sanity. But if you look at all those tests, as a psychotherapist called Dan Siegel has pointed out, if you look at all those tests and all those ways of defining our insanity, insanity actually falls into two camps. And these two camps are either being too chaotic or being too rigid. And so the same place is between chaos and rigidity. That's when you're not so chaotic that you've got no structure in your life, but nor are you so rigid that you can't be flexible.
Do most of us have to swim a little harder against the pull of one side or the other as we maintain our sanity?
I do think that in some areas we tend to be chaotic, in others we tend to be rigid. And so in different areas of our lives, sometimes we'll be swimming and need to swim in one direction and sometimes in another. For instance, we might be really fluid when it comes to, what work we can do. And we might be very sort of psychologically sound in the area of work. But then we might have a lot of out-of-date rules that we're living by, say, in the area of relationships. So we can be rigid in one area of our lives and chaotic in another.
You know, it's funny, reading this book, Philippa, which I enjoyed very much, it struck me that in this era, we understand completely that diet and exercise and preventative care are important for our physical health. And yet many of us seem to believe that mental health ought to just come to us unless there's some kind of problem in our lives.
Well, that isn't a bad policy if you've had good enough parents. If you've had parents that validate your experience when you're growing up and contain you enough to keep you safe but give you enough freedom so you can do your own exploration, and who know how to be present with you so you've got a feeling that you're worthwhile and worth spending time with, then maybe you don't have to think about it. So because, say, a small percentage of the population can be sane without thinking about it, some of the rest of us have thought maybe that we can go along that line as well, but actually most of us haven't had an ideal upbringing. Our parents do their best, but they had the disadvantage of having their parents maybe. So it's really good to actually do a little bit of work on our sanity.
So one of the areas you suggest we put in a little bit of effort is to perform self-observation. What does that encompass, and what makes it such a valuable tool for mental health?
Well, unless you know what it is you're doing in the first place, you haven't really got a choice about whether you carry on doing it or do something different. So it's really good to be aware of what we're doing. For example, if we're like super critical all the time and we're really critical of other people, it's quite good to clock that, to notice that, hang on, I'm being critical again. Because after a while you realize maybe it's my pattern to be critical rather than the people around me needing criticism. So it's really good to notice your process the whole time, so that you have more choices, more option as to whether you carry on, say, being critical, or decide maybe to look at that behaviour to see whether you can change it and whether that would improve your life. I mean, that's just an example, but basically, we become ourselves when we allow ourselves to become ourselves, not when we try to be someone else. I don't know if you're with me, what I'm talking about here.
In other words, we have to sort of accept who we are and rather than trying to fit into a box that we don't belong in?
Yes, it's sort of like the more we're aware of who we are, the more we can become who we are rather than to try to be something we're not. So let's think of an example. For instance, we're an outgoing person and maybe we feel ashamed about how outgoing we are because maybe in our past people have told us we're precocious or a show-off or something like that. It's good to know that actually that's who I am. So rather than trying to quiet yourself down, just embracing who you are, if you know who you are. I don't know if I'm making any sense at all, actually.
No. You absolutely are. It makes perfect sense. And the other thing that I think is interesting is that when we don't examine our lives, our actions, our behaviors on a fairly regular basis, you write about that we have this sort of natural tendency to simply justify everything rather than wondering whether there's something that we might do with a little more mindfully.
We all have in place a sort of baloney generator because what we can't stand is being uncertain. Mm-hmm. We don't like it if we don't know why we haven't done something. So what we tend to do is quickly rush to a reason, like I didn't reply to the invitation because it was a stupid invitation, rather than think, well, maybe I didn't reply to it because I felt nervous or didn't know what to do or I don't know what the invitation means. We tend to go straight into a judgment. And that automatic judgment machine, I call a baloney generator. Because if we just hold on and say, okay, what am I actually feeling here? And am I rushing to this judgment just to justify those feelings? I think we can actually open out our lives a little bit more rather than close them down.
This is really interesting. Rather than, you know, people might be hearing this and hearing us talking about self-observation, but rather than cultivating narcissism, you say that self-observation actually helps us avoid being obsessed with ourselves. How does that work?
Well, people that sort of damn self-observation, you know, tend to think of it as a sort of navel-gazing, a sort of a self-obsessed way of being. But actually, it's the opposite of that. It's daring to challenge ourselves. And that actually takes quite a lot of courage. Rather than sort of blaming other people around us, it means perhaps taking more responsibility for what happens in our own lives.
And you suggest for many people it's helpful to keep a journal. Talk about what we should record in it and how we might use that information.
When we keep a journal, it's very sort of different from sort of keeping a record that you imagine somebody else might read or keeping a record, you know, to put down your appointments in. Keeping a journal is really a way of just writing automatically thoughts and feelings as they occur and just keeping up with them. And it's a good thing to do it just as you wake up in the morning to write two or three pages of sort of automatic writing, as it were. I mean, I don't mean not writing letters and words, but just writing your thoughts as they occur without censoring them. And then when you look at it, you can actually see what's going on and you can look at patterns. There's nothing that you actually should be writing, but it's quite good to keep this discipline up and then look back and then you can sort of spot recurring patterns.
You know, it's interesting, Philippa, you talk about you're not writing for an audience. Is that where people get hung up, that somehow they worry that at some point this thing, this document will be discovered and it needs to have, I don't know, literary value or needs to sort of make sense in a broad way rather than being a daily tool for our own personal use?
Well, there is always the fear of your diary being discovered, mm-hmm. of course, your journal being discovered. But if we are sort of really worried about what somebody will think of us because of what we write, I mean, that is a good indicator that maybe we get a little bit scared of making a mark on our own lives as well because we are too worried about what other people think of us. In the book, I talk about something called internal and external referencing. Mm-hmm. And what this is if you internally reference, what you ask yourself is, what does this feel like to me? You know, what are my sensations when I'm doing this activity? If you externally reference, you think, what do other people think of me when I'm doing this? And how do I look when I'm doing this? And what impression am I making? Am I impressing people? Am I making them envious? And if we're too focused on what other people think, we lose contact with our own inner core and what works for us. And on the other hand, if we're too focused on our own sensation of what things feel like, we might not be relating to the outside world sufficiently to keep contacts going. So it's a matter of balance. Hmm. And if you're overly worried about what somebody thinks about a diary you don't intend to show anyone, it would be an indicator to me that maybe you're externally referencing a little bit too much.
And trying to be aware of even our sensory perception of the world can be something as simple as paying attention while you're washing the dishes to what everything feels like.
If you don't do that, if you don't sometimes get in a state of mindfulness of being in the present. I'm not suggesting we do it all the time. But if we don't do that, we tend to lose touch with ourselves a little bit because we're always, you know, when we're washing the dishes, we're thinking about the cup of tea. And when we're thinking about when we're having the cup of tea, we're thinking we've got to put the kids to bed. And when we're putting the kids to bed, we're thinking about that we've got to ring somebody up. So we're always sort of in the future and we lose touch with ourselves in the present. So being mindful of what we're thinking and feeling and sensing in the present is a lovely grounding tool that actually gives you contact with yourself and can make you feel less lonely, more content, and actually more alive in the present moment.
Does it get easier to live in the present when you practice this exercise frequently?
It does get easy with practice because when we do something for the first time, we haven't actually got a neural pathway for it. Mm. If we practice it over and over again, we lay down a little bit of a neural pathway, so it does actually become easier. But I'm not suggesting we live in the mindful present the whole time. I mean, we humans are born with the great gift of being able to predict the future, and I'm not suggesting we throw that away. It's just like staying sane is a matter quite often of avoiding extremes and staying balanced.
Philippa Perry is my guest. She's a psychotherapist and author of the new book, How to Stay Sane. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes, and we now have phone lines open for you if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment. That number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychotherapist Philippa Perry. Her new book is called How to Stay Sane. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You talk about the importance of having relationships to other people, Philippa, in a life that is happy and sane. They don't necessarily, though, have to be romantic, but they do have to be important relationships.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we can't really talk about a healthy brain as if it's an isolated entity. That's a bit of nonsense. Brains actually don't happen on their own. Our brains are formed in relationship with other people, and they continue to develop in relationship with other brains.
So what is the difference in communicating with people that we have relationships with between dialogue and what you call monologue disguised as dialogue?
I'm not going to dismiss monologue disguised as dialogue as being useless, mm-hmm. because sometimes we can have the illusion of being kept company when, instead of having a conversation, we're holding two separate monologues, like somebody says their bit and then you say your bit. It's just that they're talking about their kids and you're talking about your wardrobe or something. But we're getting stuff off our chest and we're debriefing it, even if there isn't much meeting between us. But a more satisfying sort of dialogue is when we listen, digest, and then share, when we allow ourselves to have mutual impact, when I allow you to impact upon me and when you allow me to impact upon you, then we have the ability to develop together, grow and change together. And you know, when you've had a really satisfying conversation, you sort of feel better and bigger for it. Mm. That's when you've had a sort of true meeting of minds, as it were. And meeting of minds usually means mutual impact as well.
Talk about this strategy that you recommend called the daily temperature reading, which at first pass sounds sort of artificial and yet also sounds like it could be really useful to people wanting deeper relationships with people.
The daily temperature reading was developed by a family therapist called Virginia Satir. And what she noticed about our ways of communicating with each other is that there's sort of five main headings that we talk under, and these are appreciations, new information, questions or queries, complaints with recommendations, and wishes, hopes, and dreams. So that's five areas. And if you look at if you become aware of how you communicate with your nearest and dearest or the people you work with, you might find that you're really strong in some areas. Let's say you're really good at making complaints, but you rarely remember to share your wishes, hopes, and dreams, or you rarely remember to give an appreciation or even any new information. So what this does is that it allows you to get exercised in the five main areas of communication, so you can communicate what might not be being communicated. And it's a good way of working more with another person rather than working with your assumptions of that other person. Hmm. And you take it in turns to share on these five areas of appreciation, new informations, questions, complaints with recommendations, and wishes, hopes, and dreams. Those are the five areas.
So clarify here, because complaints with recommendations is the one that sounds like it could get problematic. This is This is not, I'm tired of taking out the trash. I recommend you start doing it or else I'm going to be furious. Can you talk about the right way to handle this?
Well, if you get a complaint and nobody tells you what you want, what they want you to do instead, you're kind of like dumped on. Mm-hmm. So if somebody says to you, "You never take off out the trash," but doesn't say it would be really good if we could take it in turns, or "I'd like you to notice when I take out the trash, and if you could appreciate me for it, I wouldn't mind so much. We never say, you know, what we would like them to do instead. So if you make a complaint, it's a really good idea if you make a suggestion for change as well. So you're not just dumping on someone. And another thing that's really important when you're making a complaint is the complaint is about you. It's not about the other person. It's you that's feeling disgruntled about the trash. It's not them that's necessarily lazy. I mean, the interesting thing is that if we added up the percentages of both people in a relationship and the chores they're supposed to do, it comes to about 150%. So everybody always thinks they're doing more than their fair share. But it's really good to sort of talk about how you feel about it in a non-blaming way and what you want to happen. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that what you want to happen will happen, but at least you've said it.
What does it mean to be mindful of our impact on other people and their emotions, and how can we know that we are accurately reading the emotional state of the people we care about?
Well, we don't. We can't. I mean, sometimes we do read people accurately, and sometimes we miss a tune and don't read them accurately. I mean, some of us have got a condition such as Asperger's or forms of autism, which means we actually can't read people because we haven't got that part of our brain functions differently to most people. But even without that, we can still miss a tune to other people. So what I recommend is this part in the daily temperature reading, which is actually questions, which means checking out assumptions. So you might presume when your partner leaves the room and slams the door that they're in a temper, but you don't know it. Perhaps the wind caught the door or something. So it's really good to check your assumptions out, because that way we don't put the onus on ourselves to be able to mind read, and we don't get angry with another person for something they hadn't thought or didn't intend. So it's really good to check out assumptions, because we're not all that good at mind reading like we think we might be. I mean, sometimes we might be spot on, but it's good to check it out. I mean, the thing that, you know, couples have great big blow-ups and arguments about is like, if you really love me, I wouldn't have to tell you that. Well, that is a myth. You do have to tell the other person what you're feeling and thinking if you want them to get you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with psychotherapist Philippa Perry, whose new book is called How to Stay Sane. Let's go on the phone now to Bob in Fort Worth. Hello, Bob.
Hi, guys. I was, when I started listening to your show, I was really quite interested by what the doctor was having you say. Is I found myself challenging a philosophy I've developed regarding that we have very little free will with respect to changing major courses of our lives until perhaps after it's all said and done, that, you know, the nurturing and naturing aspects have been set down and made us who we are. And as we've grown up and gone the paths, unless you're in the business that you're in and constantly studying this sort of thing, I feel as though, you know, there's very little room, wiggle room, to make the major changes. You know, perhaps in the later stages of life, like I'm in, you can maybe start reflecting and making some improvements. But until then, I'm of the belief that you get to where you are without that little man controlling something outside of just, like I said, the nature and nurture that's been set down. I'd like to hear your take on that, Doc.
Okay, so to sum up what you're saying, Bob, you believe that because of, you know, the genes we've been dealt and the environment we've grown up in, we're pretty much fixed, and we haven't got as much free will as we think we have. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Well, what you have got, Bob, though, is your feelings. And the great thing about feelings, if we allow ourselves to feel them but not actually be them, is that we can observe them and use them as a guide to actually what we want and what we might want to change. I mean, there's a big difference between saying, I am angry and I feel angry. Because if we say, I am angry, what we're saying is that that's our whole person definition. We're defining ourselves. But if we say, I feel angry, what we're doing is we're observing ourselves. So we think, well, what can I do about that? It gives us a little bit more power. So we maybe have got a little bit of free will, even though sometimes it does seem that we are on a predetermined and predestined course. But when we sort of practice thinking for ourselves rather than thinking automatically, we find that we have more and more will. So I think that is the key to it, is to look where we've come from and look where we're going to go and see where we'd like to change course. And then maybe we're not on such a predetermined, and we're not sort of victims to our pre-written destiny, as sometimes it feels like. Change happens, really, when we become what we are and not what we, when we try to become what we're not. I think that's where we get stuck with change, where we feel like we can't change, is when we try to be something so completely different to what we are that it's impossible. But I think when we accept who we are and what we do and become aware of that, then we are in a much better position to change. And we don't have to be a psychoanalyst to be able to do that. Anyone can do that. And I've got lots of exercises in my book, How to Stay Sane, that can help you become more aware of who you are rather than somebody trying to force themselves to doing something they're not. Is anybody with me?
Yeah, I think that makes great sense. I want to talk a little bit, Philippa, about your writing on stress, which was fascinating because we have so, not in your profession perhaps, but in the general culture, we've so oversimplified that term that we've come to believe that by definition stress is a bad thing and it must be avoided whenever possible. Talk about the difference between bad stress and good stress.
Well, if we don't have any stress at all and we don't have any challenges, what I call our comfort zone is just going to get smaller and smaller. I mean, what we're capable of taking on and capable of thinking about, it's a little bit like a muscle. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it. And the same goes for your brain power. So it's good, actually, to have problems that we overcome because it keeps our brain subtle. So I think that a certain amount of stress, a certain amount of difficulty is actually good for us.
So how do we find activities and challenges that will help to expand our comfort zone without absolutely terrifying us?
Well, I'm a great believer in keep on learning. So I think it's a really good thing to do to challenge yourself to maybe learn a musical instrument or learn how to knit, to set yourself a task so that you have to work very hard to lay down some new neural pathways. You know, it literally expand your brain. It used to be thought that we couldn't make any new brain cells, but recent research has showed us that our brains are plastic. They are not fixed. We can expand them. I was reading in the Guardian newspaper, a newspaper we have over here in the UK this weekend, about a man who taught himself to play the piano. Well, he didn't teach himself, he had teachers, at the age of 50 and learned how to play a really difficult piece of music. And what that has done for him in other areas of his life. It expands the whole of your life when you expand a bit of it. Yeah. And for me, a couple of years ago, I trained and ran the London Marathon. And because I achieved that, it gave me so much more confidence in lots of other areas of my life. So I think it's good to set ourselves challenges, whether it's learning the piano, taking on a more difficult job, or setting yourself a goal like the London Marathon or the New York Marathon or something like that, and actually achieving it, because it seems to actually expand you, make you more open rather than close you down. We can get very comfortable and set in our habits, and when we do that, we tend to retract. So I think it's good to set ourselves new challenges.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Tony on the line in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Hey, I got in the middle of the program, and I didn't know if you addressed this, but I was listening to what you're saying about present-mindedness, and I just wondered if this has any connection with Gestalt therapy or Zen, as that seems to be the core of their therapeutic effort, and I'll take my answer on the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, well, Gestalt therapy and Zen, both do exhort the benefits of mindfulness. So, yes, everything is kind of linked up, and different disciplines actually sometimes say that we should do very similar things. They just dress it up in different clothes, really. I can't talk for Zen mindfulness because I don't know very much about it, but one of the core teachings of Gestalt therapy is to be self-aware and mindful of your thoughts, feelings, and sensations in the present.
My guest is Philippa Perry. She's a psychotherapist and author of the new book, How to Stay Sane. We'll come back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with psychotherapist Philippa Perry, author of the new book, How to Stay Sane. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Philippa, what is the role of the stories that we tell ourselves and about our lives in our mental health?
Well, just listening to some of your news bulletins there, we do seem to be drawn to the most sort of emotional type news, which is sort of like news about conflict, about war. And I think this can give us a distorted picture of the actual world we live in. I mean, most of us do live in peace and peaceful lives, but to hear the news, you wouldn't think that. And because we listen to it so much, I think we're actually probably maybe getting a little bit more pessimistic about human nature and about our world than the world actually warrants. I mean, I'm not saying horrible wars and conflicts don't happen, but they might not be happening all the time, and they might not be happening all the time in our neighborhood, is what I mean to say. Mm-hmm. Although they are actually happening around the world in the whole time, but these stories that we hear the whole time do affect our mental health and do maybe give us a sort of a pessimistic distortion on the world. The stories we tell ourselves do form us. We begin to make sense of the world when we're sitting on our mother's knee and we put our parents put our sort of feelings into words for us, and that's the beginning of our self-narrative, and we jointly create that with our earliest caregivers, and it is a story. Now, the great thing about stories is that we can edit them. And we had a caller on earlier called Bob who was a little bit pessimistic about our ability to edit our story. But we really can. We can become our own editors.
And in fact, you write that successful therapy is very often, at least in part, about rewriting the narratives that come to define us in harmful ways.
That's right. I mean, we might have some sort of spoken or unspoken self-beliefs that actually don't do us any good, such as, you know, oh, all my relationships fail. I mean, that isn't a story that's going to help you if it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So I always like to have a look at my clients' stories, see what they're telling themselves, and see whether we could actually edit the story so we could have a different ending.
And it's not about saying that different things have happened to you. It's simply about reframing them. Is that right?
Well, what has happened. But the way we narrate what has happened can be different. I mean, if we have a story that goes, oh, everything's terrible, what we tend to do when we tell a story is cherry pick things that back that story up. If we had a story that went, everything's going okay, maybe we cherry-pick things that back that up. We make our minds up in a flash, and then we just look for evidence to back up that original flash. Hmm. What I'm saying is that we could maybe not be so quick to come to a conclusion and look at all the evidence rather than cherry-picking facts to back up our initial impression.
What does it take to rewrite the narratives for particular relationships that have become troubled or have become stagnant?
Well, human beings are not set in stone. We are organic creatures. And, you know, our cells divide and multiply. We are flexible. And so, therefore, a relationship can change. And I think to think of ourselves as organic creatures that are capable of change is a way of keeping our relationships flexible rather than fixed. We can grow and develop, and we can do that together, or we can do that separately, and then come together and go apart, come together. But we're not fixed in stone, and things can move.
We
don't have to get stuck, is what I'm saying.
We have an email here from Len at the Dallas Peace Center who says, hearing you relate communications between individuals along with being able to express wants and needs sounds very much like nonviolent communications as developed by Marshall Rosenberg. I found this a very valuable tool to be able to communicate compassionately. What is your experience with nonviolent communications?
A good thing about nonviolent communication is respecting difference. I mean, we're all very good at getting on with people that have the same viewpoint as ourselves. It takes a little bit more energy and more imagination to respect people who are different to us and to actually put ourselves in their shoes and to understand where they're coming from. And then, when we've done that, to communicate that we've done that. If we could only take the time to do that, I think there would be less violent conflict in all of our lives.
What does it take? You know, we spoke earlier about confidence that we have the ability to change, about learning to reframe our personal narratives. Is it a sort of like step-by-step process to build a more optimistic outlook on the world if that doesn't come naturally to us?
What somebody's steps are, though, are going to be different. So in my book, I'm not laying down sort of points 1 to 10. You've got to do this, followed by that, followed by this, because one size does not fit all. We are all different. I mean, some of us come from a more chaotic, and some of us are more rigid. So what one person needs to do more of, another person will need to do less of. But what I do is lay down a framework for us to look at our lives to see how and where we need to change them. But what we need to change is going to be different for each person. So what I suggest we do is look at our lives through four different lenses. And these are self-observation, how we relate to others, new learning to keep ourselves open, or as we talked about earlier, you know, allowing enough good stress in our lives to keep ourselves flexible by learning new things, and the stories we tell ourselves. Now, if we sort of divide the psyche into these four areas, as it were, it's easier to break it down to see what we need to do to feel saner. Are you with me?
Yes, absolutely.
You
remind us in the book not to neglect examining the narratives of our families of origin so that we create a sort of narrative family tree that you call a genogram. Can you talk about that and what the function is?
I just want to say that I didn't invent the genogram, but I can't remember offhand who did, but I do say in my book who did. What it is it's a family tree, but as well as all the people there and when they lived and died, you actually put the history of who sort of traits, family traits, who got on with people, who didn't get on with people, what the general feeling you have about each member of your family, each generation of your family. And if you do that, you can actually see how psychological patterns are repeated. And then it's much easier to see that you've sort of taken things on board automatically without thinking. You've absorbed stuff that you actually don't need. When you look at it on a family tree like that, I've laid it out in the book how to actually do it, you have far more choice about, actually, I don't need to, say, be so suspicious about men. You know, that was my mother's experience. My experience is different. I don't have to take on board her suspicions. That's just an example. But if you look at your family habits through the family tree, and maybe look at your partner's family habits through his family tree, you might be able to see what arguments you're having and why, where they come from. So it might not be you and your partner having an argument. It might be your ancestors having an argument. And once you've put that down in your genogram, these sort of family trees, it's much easier to sort it out than it is if it's not on paper.
What can we do to sort of assist with those we care about feeling sane and mentally healthy? And what are the limits of our powers to change things for other people?
I think the greatest gift you can give to another person is to be present with them. That means to really listen to them, not listen to them while checking your messages on your phone, but really being with another person is, and trying to get them, trying to understand them through their eyes, not through ours, is the way we can not only help another person, but also expand ourselves, because we expand ourselves by encompassing their experience as well as our own.
And in cases where we want to really understand someone and see them as they see themselves, you also write about the fact that certain cultures, it's a gift to, for example, ask a question that might feel personal in another culture. And in other cultures, it's a gift to respect one's privacy. Can you talk a little bit about negotiating that?
Well, the thing is, each culture has a different code of manners. So it's pretty difficult to get it right for someone the whole time. So rather than look at the superficial code of manners, it's difficult. We can try to attune to people, try to put the code of manners and assumptions to one side, and to be more present with them and be with them, to rely less on manners and more on getting the essence of another person, sort of being more in relationship with them. But there's so many assumptions we can make about someone because of where we've come from and not realizing that they've come from a completely different place. I mean, for instance, in Texas, there's wide open deserts. So there's maybe a feeling, I'm guessing, I don't know, but maybe you have more of a feeling coming from Texas of spaciousness than I do.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that makes you easier, say, to welcome people into your space because you feel you've got plenty of it. Now, in the underground train system in London, nobody's going to look at anybody in the eye because we're all packed in the train like sardines. So if somebody from Texas coming into our trains might think we're a really unfriendly lot. But it's just that our way of being polite is not to encroach upon somebody else's space because we haven't got very much of it. Whereas avoiding eye contact in another country might seem really rude. So everybody has different cultures and different ways of being. And the best way, I suppose, is not to make an assumption based on our own culture, what somebody else means when they come from a different one.
Is it any more or less difficult to stay sane in 2013 than it ever has been?
No. I think it's always been really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's possibly easier to stay sane now because we're more allowing for difference. And we allow other people to be themselves more than we have in the past. I think we're getting better at emotional intelligence. And so I wouldn't say it was more difficult, no.
Mm.
I mean, we've got most of us have got fresh running water now, and that must make things easier than, you know, having to go to the well.
The new book by psychotherapist and writer Philippa Perry is called How to Stay Sane. Philippa, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. And if anybody wants to ask me something, they can find me on Twitter. I'm Philippa, that's Philippa, _ Perry, Perry, at Twitter. And I look forward to hearing from you if you want to tweet me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast free, find out about upcoming programs, and learn more about the show at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.